Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 30th of January, these are our main stories. The WHO has called for concerted international action to stop the spread of the new coronavirus that's emerged in China. As Democrats press for him to testify at the impeachment trial, the White House has told the former National Security Advisor John Bolton that his controversial new book cannot be published unless classified information is removed. Brexit has comfortably passed its final hurdle, an overwhelming ratification vote in the European Parliament. Also in this podcast,
the thousands of chemicals in tobacco smoke corrupt and mutate the DNA in your lungs. They transform them from healthy to cancerous.
Scientists have discovered that the lungs have a remarkable ability to recover from the damage caused by smoking once people quit. The whole world needs to be on alert. That's the message from the World Health Organization. On Thursday, the WHO will be holding an urgent meeting to discuss whether the coronavirus outbreak in China is an international public health emergency. So far, nearly 6,000 people have been infected in the country, with 132 deaths. The city of Wuhan is the epicentre of the outbreak, but the virus has spread across China and to other countries, including Thailand, France, the US and Australia. Here's Dr. Michael Ryan from the WHO speaking in Geneva.
We have an intense response going on in Wuhan and Hubei province. We have responses going on in other provinces in China where transmission is less intense, the numbers are less, but nonetheless a major response is underway to track cases, contacts and try to interrupt chains of transmission. We have the 15 countries who have imported cases. They have to stop transmission. Some of them are doing that extremely well. All of them are actually taking good action, but some need some help and assistance with lab and other expertise, and we're doing that from WHO. But the whole world needs to be on alert now. The whole world needs to take action and be ready for any cases that come.
Dr. Michael Ryan from the WHO. Meanwhile, as we record this podcast, reports are emerging that a planned flight on Thursday to bring hundreds of British nationals from Wuhan back to the United Kingdom will not leave as previously anticipated. Earlier, the UK's Health Minister, Matt Hancock, said the passengers would have been isolated for 14 days as public safety was the top priority. On Wednesday, before the latest reports, our Beijing correspondent John Sudworth spoke to some of the British people in Wuhan as they made preparations for the flight home.
Planes full of Japanese and US citizens have already left.
It's the night before the Great Escape.
But the Brits are still only preparing to leave.
Vera is on the flight. She's packing.
Khan Lambert's grandmother, Vera, got stuck while visiting him in Wuhan. She's running low on her medications.
I think it's been an absolute shambles, to be honest with you. I don't think the government have really known what they've been doing. I don't think they've had as much contact with the Chinese authorities as they say, because if they had, you know, I would assume that they had been getting the same information that the Americans had got, that the Japanese had got, and they'd have been able to put plans in place sooner rather than, you know, later.
Across China, few are taking any chances. Villagers are putting up roadblocks. At this one, they're spraying cars with disinfectant. No outsiders are allowed in at all.
That report by John Sudworth in China. The White House has told the former National Security Advisor John Bolton that his new book, reportedly containing damaging evidence for President Trump, cannot be published because it breaks secrecy laws. A letter from the National Security Council says the manuscript can only see the light of day if top secret information is deleted. Earlier, Mr. Trump accused Mr. Bolton of betrayal, angrily suggesting that when in the White House, he'd encouraged him to start a war. Leaked excerpts from the book appear to bolster the impeachment case of Democratic prosecutors trying to remove Mr. Trump from office. The Democrats are pressing for him to appear as a witness. In the formal procedure of the Senate, it was the presiding judge, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, who had to read out the questions submitted by the senators. This one, addressed to the lead Democratic representative, Adam Schiff, from the Senate Minority Leader, the Democrat Chuck Schumer.
The Democratic leader asks the House managers. John R. Bolton's forthcoming book states that the president wanted to continue withholding $391 million in military aid to Ukraine until Ukraine announced investigations into his top political rival and the debunked conspiracy theory about the 2016 election. Is there any way for the Senate to render a fully informed verdict in this case without hearing the testimony of Bolton, Mulvaney, and the other key eyewitnesses, or without seeing the relevant documentary evidence?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The short answer to that question is no. There's no way to have a fair trial without witnesses. And when you have a witness who is as plainly relevant as John Bolton, who goes to the heart of the most serious and egregious of the president's misconduct, who has volunteered to come and testify, to turn him away, to look the other way, I think is deeply at odds with being an impartial juror.
Representative Adam Schiff making the case for calling John Bolton as a witness. Tim Franks heard more from Daniel Lipman, the White House reporter for Politico.
Democrats are feeling a little more nervous that they won't be able to get enough Republicans to support witnesses later this week. And so that's a little deflating for them.
Why has that changed? Because there had been talk that there was a majority of Republicans. Well, not a majority of Republicans, but there's going to be a majority in the Senate.
I think Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is very good at his job. And he has stayed Majority Leader for quite a number of years for being able to read his caucus. And also the news cycle goes so fast in Washington, where the Bolton news on Sunday night, even though it's just Wednesday, feels like ages ago. And so he has been able to corral his senators to try to prevent those witnesses. But we don't know if he's totally successful. Some senators have not announced their positions. And so it's still possible that we could see witnesses. I think Republicans are They're worried that if you open it to one witness, then the trial just lasts a much longer time. And it also becomes harder for them to vote to acquit Trump if you hear all of this damaging testimony from people like John Bolton.
Right. And I guess actually there's probably a small number of Democratic senators, particularly four of them, who still want to become the Democratic nominee for president, who would probably be quite keen for there not to be, I mean, privately for there not to be witnesses so they can get on with their jobs.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's also some Democrats who privately say that even if we do get witnesses, Republicans would likely still vote to keep Trump in office. And so it is in the party's interest to get this trial over with, for us to move on to other issues of the day that Democrats feel are more in their advantage, like healthcare and the economy in some ways, rather than impeachment, which has continued on for months, and the American public is sometimes sick of it.
So, right, what's the next stage of this? From what I understand, there's going to be 2 days of questioning from the senators, and then what?
Yeah, so 2 days likely, and then Friday we could see that vote on witnesses, and if that vote fails, then we're likely to see an acquittal vote either Friday night or Saturday.
Oh, really? It could come that quickly?
It could get. We're in the last stages of this trial, assuming that witness vote is not successful.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we are in Washington here.
Daniel Lipman, the White House reporter for Politico. The European Parliament has ratified Brexit, the last hurdle before the United Kingdom leaves the European Union on Friday after 47 years. Only 49 members voted against, many of them British opponents of Brexit. Some of them were in tears as they were given a minute each to make a valedictory speech. The head of the Brexit party, Nigel Farage, for many years the driving force behind Britain's departure, waved a union flag. The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, wished the UK well. Our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly, reports from Brussels.
There were no surprises in the politics of the European Parliamentary Chamber. MEPs have been kept in the loop at every stage of the Brexit negotiations, and their approval of it is effectively baked into the withdrawal agreement. But there was a clear sense that if this is not quite a historic moment itself, it is at least preparation for a historic moment on Friday night, when the UK actually leaves. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, sought to encapsulate twin themes of looming departure and enduring friendship.
I want to use the words of the famous British poet George Eliot. She said, "Only in the agony of parting do we look into the depth of love. We will always love you and we will never be far. Long live Europe."
As British MEPs prepared to vote for the last time, the Brexit Party's members were inevitably in happier mood. As their leader Nigel Farage explained, they brought in union flags to wave to mark the moment.
"I know you're going to miss us. I know you want to ban our national flags, but we're going to wave you goodbye and we'll look forward in the future to working with you."
The presiding Vice President of the European Parliament, Mairead McGuinness, intervened to cut Mr Farage off. For now, at least, EU rules still apply to the UK.
"I'm really pleased. Sit down, resume your seats, put your flags away, you're leaving, and take them with you if you are leaving now."
Overall, the tone in Parliament today was sombre and occasionally even a little sentimental. Even before the UK has actually gone, more than one speaker predicted that at some point the British will be back.
Kevin Connolly in Brussels. Scientists say lungs can repair the genetic damage caused by smoking, but only if people quit. Even those who smoked a pack a day for 40 years before they stopped saw an improvement. The surprise findings have been published in the journal Nature. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
The thousands of chemicals in tobacco smoke corrupt and mutate the DNA in your lungs. They transform them from healthy to cancerous, and it was long thought that this genetic damage was permanent. But now a study by University College London and the Sanger Institute shows the lungs can recover. They performed a detailed genetic analysis of lung tissue from people who did not have cancer. In smokers, the overwhelming majority of cells have been mutated by tobacco smoke. Those cells have been altered up to 10,000 times. But a small proportion of cells seem to exist in what the researchers described as a nuclear bunker and escape the genetic devastation caused by smoking. When you quit, it's these cells that spread and heal the lungs. In people who quit, up to 40% of cells look just like those from people who never smoked. Dr. Peter Campbell from the Sanger Institute said it was a massive surprise.
"We were totally unprepared for the finding that perhaps there are cells that can regenerate and replenish in the normal airways. One of the remarkable things about this study was that we found patients who had quit smoking even after 40 years of cigarette smoking had regeneration of cells that were totally unscathed by the exposure to tobacco."
This doesn't mean quitting eliminates all the risk of lung cancer, but Cancer Research UK said it was a double win for patients. Their lungs repair past damage, and by no longer smoking, they avoid further mutations.
That report by James Gallagher. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
The Compass is the podcast from the BBC World Service that really gets under the skin of a story.
"I can tell you what I believe is not the truth, and you know it's not the truth, and I'll get away with it. So I will tell a lie."
With series that take an in-depth look at how the world today really works.
"Sometimes I think that we are moving into the right direction and change is happening. And then I realize that 9 to 10 women get killed every day in this country. So I don't feel we're moving forward at all.
And why things are the way they are."
"I have been socialized to be a soldier, to be someone aggressive and even to dominate, especially women or other people. So I have this kind of fear that what if I one day become a violent person?"
The Compass Podcast from the BBC World Service.
"She shamed the politicians into taking an interest in it."
Search for The Compass wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to this podcast. A primary school in the Indian state of Karnataka is being investigated by police after a complaint that children insulted the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, in a school play. The script was described as objectionable and seditious. A clip of the play has gone viral. So why was it so controversial? Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, has been looking into it.
What you see is a clip of children who were 9 and 10 years old speaking in a school hall, putting on a play, and they're role-playing for an annual performance to parents, basically looking at this very controversial issue in India at the moment to do with the amendments to the citizenship bill. And it sounds as though they were encouraged, some of them, by their parents, according to the school, to use quite colourful language and express their arguments quite strongly. And one person in particular felt that this was controversial because in doing that, one child, and there were also some other controversial comments, was rude about the Prime Minister. That individual person filed a complaint with the police, and the suggestion is that they're examining it with the possibility of sedition charges. Now, some people are suggesting sedition is a very, very big hammer to use to crack what seems actually a very small walnut.
What is sedition?
It's about a group or a person saying something or doing something which threatens to overthrow India or to overthrow the government. It can carry life imprisonment. But one of the things that's been difficult in recent years is that these charges of sedition, which are very vague and quite broadly defined, have been used a lot, far more than they have been in previous decades. And they've been targeting in the recent past, journalists and activists and students on campus and protesters. So certainly people who are concerned about what's happening in India are saying they feel the authorities are using these laws of sedition nowadays to stifle free speech and stop protest.
And that concern, I presume, is shared by the parents of those children at this school.
We understand that the parents have written a letter acknowledging that what they did was perhaps not helpful and recognising that a mistake, that was the word that was used, has occurred. The fact that there has been that kind of apology might be enough to make this go away. Because we're at an early stage, a case has been registered, but that doesn't actually mean charges have been filed. If we get to the stage that the police investigate this and say, yes, there is a case to answer, yes, we will go to a magistrate, yes, we are going to go ahead with sedition proceedings, that becomes very serious indeed. People could be in jail for a very long time.
Jill McGivering. Boeing says the financial fallout from its 737 MAX airliner crisis will exceed $18 billion. Boeing's most profitable plane has been grounded since last March following two fatal crashes which killed 346 people. Our business correspondent Samira Hussein has the details from New York.
For the first time in more than two decades, Boeing has reported a loss. The 737 MAX planes have been grounded since March last year because of two fatal crashes that killed a total of 346 people. Since the MAX fleet was removed from service, Boeing has suspended production and deliveries of its best-selling and most profitable model. The cost of the crisis was thought to have reached nearly £7 billion, but today's announcement suggests the final bill could be more than double that. The company's chief executive was sacked late last year because of how he dealt with it, and the company recently told customers it did not expect the planes to be back in service until this summer at the earliest.
Samira Hussein in New York. More and more African Americans are buying so-called African print, a bright, patterned fabric which is seen as quintessentially African. But it turns out lots of it is made in Asia. That's because it's considerably cheaper. Even in West Africa, it's cheaper to buy African print made in Asia. But first, Claire Spencer talked to a designer about how she started importing clothes made with African print to the US.
Hi, welcome to Brown Sugar and Aphrodisiac Worldwide. I was in Chicago visiting. I'm walking across Roosevelt Avenue Bridge, and this woman, she parks her car, puts her blinkers on, and comes running across the street to me, and she goes, excuse me, where did you get that jumpsuit? That fabric is amazing. And I said, well, I live in West Africa, in Ghana. And she said, well, can you make that for me? And that's how it all started.
The designer Chiedza Makonnen had chanced upon a demand that wasn't being met,
African print for people in America.
I made one for her. I shipped it out to her. Then her cousin wanted it, her friend wanted it, and it just kind of spiraled after that.
An increased demand for African print in the US was something Ama Abuagwe's Ghanaian parents also noticed.
I was in my parents' store. They have an Afro-Caribbean grocery store, and they sell fabric. And fabric was being delivered by an Indian man who imports his fabrics from India. And this print never actually touched the continent, as in it came directly from Asia to the United States of America into the store.
For her, this was problematic.
People were connecting with the fabric as a representation of their identity, of their culture, of a place of heritage. However, it had no economic benefit for that place. And that's when I really started to ask questions.
She now wants to be a broker for a truly African wax print.
What we're trying to do is connect African and Afro-Diasporan businesses around the world, really, so that we can build generational wealth.
There'll be one big challenge, and that's that the Asian versions are a lot cheaper, as I found out when I went to buy some. In Accra's Makwala Market, the so-called African print is stacked from floor to ceiling in a seemingly infinitesimal combination of bright colours and patterns. I'm here with Sarah, the owner of Unity's shop, in a small little alleyway on Makwala Market. How much would 6 yards of fabric cost from the Ghanaian company GTP compared to 6 yards from the Chinese company High Target?
So GTP, you can get 6 yards for 130 cedis.
How much would it cost for the Chinese brand High Target for 6 yards?
High Target 6 yards is 55 cedis.
So $23 for 6 yards for the Ghanaian brand compared to $10 for the Chinese brand. How has this changed things for your shop?
Everybody loves African print, but it's not everybody that can afford it. But they want affordable, so they're going for the High Targets.
Why is it so much cheaper in Ghana to buy African print made in Asia? One person who has been looking at this is Kenneth Sari, who's the manager of ATL, a Ghanaian factory that's been struggling to compete.
They are cheaper because they have economy of scale. I was in Pakistan just recently. Their energy, their electricity consumption, they are spending around $5 per yard. Currently, I'm doing between $10 to $15 per yard. That has really affected us.
That's something Ama will have to work around if she's going to one day fulfil her dream of supplying African print made in Africa.
That report by Claire Spencer in Ghana. Now, back to our main story. The World Health Organization says the whole world needs to take action to stop the spread of the new coronavirus, which emerged in China. As the number of cases continues to grow, the WHO will decide on Thursday whether to declare a global health emergency. In another development, the top football team from Wuhan, the city at the centre of the outbreak, has arrived for its winter training camp in Malaga in southern Spain. The plane bringing the players of Wuhan Zal touched down on Wednesday. Tim Frank spoke to Daryl Finch, sports editor of the English language edition of Malaga's Sur newspaper, and asked what the reaction had been to the team's arrival in Malaga.
It's on a lot of people's minds. Whether they're concerned about it is another matter. Of course, when someone coughs, people are like, oh, it's the coronavirus. And elsewhere, at pharmacies, face masks have actually sold out. There's none can be found anywhere. So I think people are conscious of it, but not necessarily panicked by it at the moment.
Presumably they're being checked. Their health is being checked.
Yes, yes, yes. They've got a doctor with them, as is normal with football teams for these sorts of things. They have been checked by the regional government as they came in, and they've reassured the public that they're showing no symptoms. But most importantly, they've not actually been to Wuhan since the 2nd of January.
Oh.
At that time, they were 1,000 kilometres away in Guangzhou, I believe it's called.
So they haven't been back to Wuhan all through the course of the outbreak. I mean, at least as far as we know, because we're fairly confident when the outbreak started. So they haven't been there since the disease began its spread.
Exactly, not since the 2nd of January. And they've assured us that none of the players show any symptoms. And of course, the maximum incubation period for the virus has now passed. So they're saying it's very low risk, but nonetheless, they're going to keep them monitored and have their temperatures checked and any possible symptoms looked at.
How long are they planning to spend in Malaga? Do you know? Is it a couple of weeks?
quite a while. They're actually scheduled to stay here till the 18th of February.
Oh, really? Gosh, so it's quite a long winter break in the Chinese league. Because I was just wondering, I mean, clearly we don't know what the state of the epidemic is going to be come the 18th of February, but I was just wondering whether any thought it might be given as to whether they want to stay on.
Well, the season, I believe, doesn't start again until March, and I think they haven't. The last season ended in October, so yeah, as you say, it is a very long, long break. So I think they're quite used to travelling around the world, normally to warmer parts of the world, such as the Costa del Sol.
Daryl Finch, sports editor of Malaga's Sur newspaper. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.